Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'm in the England dressing room.
Bring us our shag coats. Where's he going? Welcome back to the front three. Oh dear, Adam Baldwin here alongside Lawrence McKenna.
You got what you deserved.
And Dave O'Brien.
Hello, hello, hello.
And Chris Hennage.
Unmute.
Good evening.
There he is.
There he is. Guys. Oh, that was shit, wasn't it? Just shit.
Yeah, it was actually pretty poor. I mean, England did... We're referring to England losing to Iceland. One of the teams of the tournament who have surprised everyone so far.
I mean, we'll come on to Iceland, I think.
Fucking squawker, Robert Sweet.
Good.
Dave. Iceland,
but first off, let's talk about England,
Dave.
An embarrassing defeat and an abject performance.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was poor, very, very poor. Didn't move the ball well, had no tempo to the game, had the wrong players on, were far too narrow. But credit to Iceland, that 4-4-2 that they play, very aggressive, very like the top teams that are competing in Spain at the moment, like Villarreal, like Sevilla, like Atletico Madrid. They played it down to a T and they played it so well and they played it positively. They were playing out from the back. They were hitting the target man when they needed to. They were running off him. It was just a great performance from Iceland. You know, don't take it away from them. England were poor, yes, but Iceland really, really performed. And, you know, France have been good in spells in this tournament. You know, the second half against the Republic of Ireland, they were brilliant. But the other two games, they sort of came alive, maybe the 80th minute. Iceland could really cause this French team a lot of trouble if France don't start from the start, don't come out guns blazing, if Antoine Griezmann isn't played as an attacking midfielder from the start. There's going to be issues there, really is going to be issues. So Iceland... ones to watch for this tournament, there really are. Again, I love the emergence of these small teams. We mentioned it in the preview podcast that there will be a team that would come alive, and this is the team for me. Iceland potentially could upset France, who are arguably one of the favourites, and then go on to play Italy or Germany. What a story that is for it. Icelandic football. You know, Rory was banging on the live show how they have a pool of 90 players and they've beaten the mighty England that have four professional divisions. Crazy.
There's no doubt that Iceland deserved to win, Lawrence. But England, there was almost this crushing inevitability about them going out to Iceland, a team they should be beating. I mean, they were so bad. I think Ian Wright had some sort of meltdown live on air. He couldn't stop comparing the game to the plot of Space Jam, saying that Iceland had stole the talent of the England players. It's not necessarily that...
I wonder who made that joke to him before he went on air.
It's not necessarily that England... it's not surprising necessarily that England were bad. It was just how bad they were. Every cross was overhit. There were wayward passes all over the pitch. There just didn't seem to be any cohesion at all.
The thing is, if it was the plot of Space Jam, then surely the Iceland players would have exhibited some of the qualities of England. But actually, they didn't. I mean, they were much better. Essentially, they'll have stolen it from some other team, not the England side, if that's the case. But also, what does that make Wayne Rooney? Does that make Wayne Rooney... Well, England lost in the end, so England are the monsters.
I think, yeah. I'm not quite sure Ian Wright really fought through his Space Jam metaphor.
Maybe it's Space Jam 2. Maybe he's seen the script beforehand.
Yeah,
I mean, yeah. Fair enough. Either way, I love Wrighty, and I think he's made some good points this tournament, so I will not hear him put down like that, Adam. But my,
it was just hard to ignore Lawrence. It was hard to ignore.
But the point would also be with England is that actually they played at quite a simple game plan that was quite easy to play against. And so a real issue with them was that essentially you couldn't... there wasn't enough creativity, there wasn't enough sort of engineering within the side, and it was all actually quite two-dimensional. So when Iceland did play their game, well, look what we came out with. They came out with a couple of goals, and they attacked England in the perfect places, like Dave's already said. So England were left sort of flat-footed. And then the only time when they didn't look flat-footed was when Rashford came on. And they, well, just attacked.
Mm. I mean, of course, Roy Hodgson stepped down after the game, Dave. I mean, obviously one of the most humiliating defeats in the national team's history, you have to say.
I do feel there's something a bit disrespectful. And I almost feel like there's a fallacy of thinking in England that people sort of think, oh, well, if we change a few figures within the game and we've got a few guys coming through that, by the way, were essentially developed by an Argentinian in the Premier League, then somehow things will be different. But actually doing this, and we said this at the last tournament, and they've said it at the previous tournament before that, doing the same thing over and over again is known as sort of madness. But essentially it's also stupidity, and that's part of the problem. You know, there are some, I mean, the headline writers and the guys who've got the massive narrative pens are probably drawing huge lines over Brexit and everything else, because the guys who are conservative within football, within the FA, are going to be saying, well, we didn't do this.
Mm.
Essentially, there are a lot of fall guys in the press, and no one's getting to the heart of it, which is that England is not developing talent in the way that they need to be developing talent. They're not training them in the way they need to be training, and it's a very there's a real lack of creation within the England side and within the England culture.
Yeah, of course, these are the same big questions that we ask after every major tournament exit, about the lack of players and how we develop them. But in terms of, before we come on to, I think we're going to come on to those big questions tomorrow, really. You know, who's going to replace Hodgson, all this sort of stuff, because no doubt this post-mortem will sort of, you know, gather pace. But for today, I mean, what do you make of the mistakes that potentially Hodgson made during the tournament and during this game, Dave? I mean, you were talking about Rashford needing to come on at halftime. You brought him on late. He made somewhat of an impact, but maybe should have been given more time to do so.
Absolutely, and so I just feel that the whole thing is a little bit too late. The decisions were very, very poor. Marcus Rashford is a player that plays without fear. It's something that I said pre-tournament, that he's a player that's played within a Louis van Gaal system and he's excelled there. Jesus, that must mean he has some talent and has some ability to do things out the blue of a system. Again, Hodgson is a system manager. They played this 4-3-3, the 4-4-2 diamond throughout qualifying and again in the tournament. The 4-3-3 that he was playing was a very outdated 4-3-3. It was more like three central midfielders, three strikers that weren't tracking back and weren't making that second band of, you know, the band of five in front of the back four. And for a player not to be in the squad, not to be in the team that gives England a bit of natural width in Marcus Rashford, was absolutely mental. What in the 8 minutes or whatever it was, the 4 minutes of normal time and the 3 minutes, the 7 minutes, sorry, you know, completing three take-ons, dribbling past three players more than any other player on, so no player on the pitch managed more. Absolutely crazy that he wasn't started. He was so exuberant and just got at the Icelandic defenders, and it's a thing that you have to do if you're facing a narrow, deep block that sits in a 4-4-2 that is happy for you to have the ball. You need to draw players in. You need to pull players out of position by dribbling at them and having a go at them, and then switching it wide, and then switching it to the other wing. But it's something England didn't do until, what, the last 4 or 5 minutes of the game, which was absolutely crazy. It seems like, again, that we sort of seen Iceland, oh, they play 4-4-2, or whatever, we'll roll these over. It seems like there's been no deep tactical analysis of what they've done, and look like, okay, we've seen that their fullback is slow, let's put on Marcus Rashford from early on. I feel like it's that we are England, that we are better than you, we're going to beat you sort of mentality.
Yeah, your chickens have come to roost, essentially. You guys think that you can go, I mean, there's a lot of people who thought they could go up there. A lot of fans who thought, not all of them, but a lot of fans who thought they could go out there and treat it like shit. Brexit treated a union like shit. A lot of people going out there with a mentality. It's true though, Adam. I mean, it's a country which essentially comes from roots which it denies and then chooses not to acknowledge and wants to think that everyone around the world likes them. They like to think they're the lovable James Bond-esque rogue that can stroll into a tournament and get through by the skin of its teeth. And it sold this continually. And then it's also sold the idea that, you know, you can get through just and things will be all right. And, you know, as long as you sort of muddle through, then everything's okay. But actually, what other countries have done is they've looked at how to progress in their football and they've taken a very humble look at their football and not done what Britain has done. And they've looked at what they do badly. Look at Germany. Look at the way they see themselves nationally. Mm. They have had a terrible history in terms of relations with other countries, not least because of the war, but because of other things as well. And you know, they're looking at that, and at least there are people who are sort of engaged enough with their politics and knowledgeable enough about their history to know and therefore not repeat the mistakes of history. But England continue to do it. And that's because there are certain fallacies in the way they think. And they have four men over and over again. Some of those four men count as Hodgson, because Hodgson was in the job too long anyway. But why would you deny a job where you'd be like, you know what, yeah, I'll give it a try. I'm not going to turn down millions of pounds every year. A really great job and a way to build myself up for no reason.
I see what you're saying about history repeating itself. I'm not sure I agree about England fans and the England team and the national team setup thinking they're loved and going in with any sort of arrogance or brashness, because
I think there's absolute
arrogance. Everyone recognizes England aren't that good.
No, that's not true though. They go in there and what they do is England don't recognize that. England keep saying it because it's that false modesty. What they want to do is go in and go, no, we're not that good, and then post tournament be like, what a comeback, the phoenix rises from the flames, just like Britain in the Second World War.
I really agree with that. You're since all about 2000 and, since about 2010 I feel well, like
I think they don't play that way though, Adam. They go with that attitude on the pitch that they can outpass people and they have the tempo to do that. You know, again, going back to what we said pre-tournament, Leicester City won the Premier League playing a counter-attacking 4-4-2, a traditional English style. We went to the tournament and we played a very sort of a cocky way, where we play a 4-3-3, play a 4-4-2 diamond. Yet we had components that could have been in that squad that could have played a 4-4-2 down to a T. And with players like, you know, Jamie Vardy and Harry Kane up front, how many minutes did those two get together as a front two? Absolutely crazy.
I don't think those mistakes, though, come from hubris. I think they come from ineptitude on the part of Roy Hodgson and the people above
them. But that ineptitude is based on what? It's based on a system which you can't just say it's just Hodgson. I mean, Hodgson is essentially fighting against so many years of issues that have been built up through the FA. And, you know, I'm not blaming it solely on that. I think it was a really poor tactical performance. I think there are a number of issues which directly relate to the side now and the issues that are immediately there, but those are short-term issues which if England were to deal with the issue or the issues that they have properly, would see a sharp change in, a sharp turn in. You see that in evidence in Germany, Spain, Italy, a number of other sides who have addressed their problems.
Of course, because I mean, even if we'd have beaten Iceland tonight, I don't think anyone thought, you know, oh, we're going to go and beat France all of a sudden because of how much better they are than us. It would have been papering over the cracks almost. I mean, in terms of this tournament, Chris, I mean, looking at it now, we've gone out to Iceland and it's been a poor tournament. We haven't beaten Russia, we failed to overcome Slovakia. It was a last minute win against Wales, and now succumbing to Iceland, as I think the guys have pointed out, have a population of 300,000 people. I mean, it's the size of Leicester essentially. What's your assessment of Hodgson in this tournament and the mistakes that have been made there?
Well, population, I don't think, has a massive impact on your ability to produce a football team. I think you look at Uruguay, they prove that there's no real correlation between the two. I think what you can say about Hodgson is he's not the right man for this job. He is a very old-school, traditional manager with a limited set of skills that I think works for small nations that want to build their international teams or their international situation from the ground up to a midpoint. England have never needed that. They've always been at the midpoint. They've been stuck at the midpoint and actually falling backwards for a long time. His inclusion as manager, to me, shows that there aren't many forward-thinking people at the Football Association to begin with. And this is long before we even broach on the subject of the institutionalized nature of picking players, largely based on clubs. Now, this is obviously a conspiracy theory that a lot of fans of lesser clubs trot out. At this precise moment, I'm struggling to see any strong case against it. because for me, Wayne Rooney, people like him, they shouldn't be starting for England right now. He's not good enough. He's simply not good enough. And it's not enough to make him the scapegoat and say he's the issue. He is really not. He is the symptom of a problem. He is not the problem. And this is one of the other issues that we get mired in, is that too often we focus on the symptoms rather than the issue at hand, which is the decision makers at the Football Association and those who decide to pay Roy Hodgson what they do and give him longevity after what was, let's not forget, a dire World Cup showing. They still chose to stick with him. And yes, he guided them through qualification with relative ease against much lesser teams. Yet when you take them to a tournament and you on paper play a team that, again, is, you would argue, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, fit into the category of a lesser team, he still can't do it. And I just have so little time for England as a team and as a concept. I struggle to see why those people who spend the money and invest in tickets and hotels and why they do it, because I don't see what they gain from it. They gain maybe a 3-0 win in Lithuania or Latvia. The most part, you look even just at the end game, the Icelandic players, and so small. It's got nothing to do with that. It really hasn't. There is a genuine connection and bond between player and fan and appreciation for what they do. There simply isn't that with England, and there hasn't been for a long time. There is a disconnect between the players and the fans that I think really harms the national team as a consequence. And part of the problem is the Premier League is marketed as the best league in Europe. Yet realistically, how many of those England players are leading men for their club or have been this season?
I mean, Chris, it's also a perfect... what about the perfect contrast with a country like Iceland, who treated a real problem in their country as the ultimate challenge for them, and have built a side with the resources they've actually had? They've acknowledged what they have, and they've acknowledged what they're working with. They've not just said, oh, we've got the best league in the world, we've got the best, we've got this, we've got that. And they've essentially looked at how to build a team out of the resources they have and built something, and then gone to a tournament and executed that well. England haven't done that.
Yeah, Iceland have adapted to the stones that were thrown in their path. The recession hit them incredibly hard. It forced a lot of domestic clubs to get rid of higher earning foreign players, and that gave opportunities to Icelandic players. I think we can talk about the infrastructure that they implemented and the pitches they built and the coaches they put through. There was also that little element of fortune in the sense of that while the recession crippled the country, it did have some benefit to at least the domestic football situation. The fact that, again, that country can be that organised, that should be another instance where you think, why is England still struggling to find that organisation? Because of the institutionalised boys club that runs the FA. And that's part of the problem, is that too many of the same people get the same jobs over and over again. There is a very small pool for what is a country that could attract much bigger. I sat and watched Chile last night and was genuinely enthralled by them as a football team and a prospect. Even when they went down to 10 men, they sort of reorganized themselves. They went to a 3-4-2, and they looked just as dangerous with 11 men as they did 10, if not even a little more dangerous than 10, as baffling as that sounds to anyone listening. But again, I look at a country like that, and I look at the way that the coach, Juan Antonio Pizzi, speaks about the supporters and appreciating them and the players and the commitment of players like Arturo Vidal. I don't see that commitment with England players. That's the other concern, is that there's a lot of the intangibles that you expect as a given at these kind of situations aren't present in this England team. And of course, in today's situation, we can really get bogged down in analytics and statistics and tactics, and Dave can speak very eloquently and articulately about how we need to look at that situation and why Rashford should play. It's a multifaceted problem, though. It's a mixture of that, and then a mixture of the fact that these players couldn't get up for this game after they went 2-1 behind. They shrunk inside themselves and never really recovered. And why is that? We need to work out as much as why is that, as much as why are these players not able to play in a cohesive unit, when some of them, Vardy, Kane, etc., have had a really good season in the domestic league.
Can't wait to see the top five reasons why England won't win the next tournament, or whatever it is, where we don't actually analyse what's going on and we just sort of try and make a series of clickbait out of it. So I do think that's part of the issue, is that people aren't currently looking to analyse anything serious. They're just looking to name things one video after another. And, you know, essentially, I think there is a big issue.
Are you talking about TFR, Lawrence?
No, what I'm saying is that there's a lot of very clickbaity things out there. There's a time for discussion, which TFR definitely covers, and then there's a time for covering news in a very in a better way. And there are times where I don't think that we particularly do that well as a sphere, because a lot of people rather get the clicks than get the analysis. They don't want the long form stuff; they want the short term hits, and that's why England have real PR issues, because people want a soundbite ahead of wanting, you know, something of actual worth. And that's why we ended up not in Europe, because people want a soundbite, which is Boris Johnson, ahead of someone who's got a longer answer, like Corbyn. And they'll blame the wrong people, but essentially there are a lot of issues, I think, with both of those things. And I do think a lot of the analysis and the relationship between Hodgson and the other guys is down to a media that wants to snipe and wants to set up a place where they can essentially get clicks ahead of sort of sending out correct information. People would rather be first and getting millions of views than second or third and getting, you know, worthwhile views with content which is actually looking at the situation.
I know, of course, there are the large problems, and like I say, they always come after major tournaments. I'm not trying to do Iceland a disservice by mentioning the population size, but you'd assume with the size of our country, there's a bigger pool talent there, bigger sample size. That's why you'd expect them to beat Iceland. Now, you're pointing out that, of course, Iceland have been more effective in the way that they've brought in new infrastructures and the way they've actually set up their national team. And of course, that's something that England haven't done for a long time. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's all going to be raked over. But some of the issues that Kristen brings up there, Dave, he's talking about player motivation. He's talking about setting up this team tactically. And surely in this tournament, that rests on Hodgson's head. And that's why, as well as all the failures of the last 4 years, he basically had to. Dave is not there anymore.
Sorry, lads, I was on mute. So technically, I think that Roy Hodgson, they should have evaluated that in the last tournament. Same issues that were there are still here now. And again, it's what kind of frustrates me is there's no one that's sort of forward thinking that we see in the media that has a chance to be in this role. Someone like Eddie Howe, that is quite a forward thinking coach, got into the coaching game very early. He's someone that should be touted as the next England manager. He should be using experience to potentially look to help to others follow that same path. You know, go back to how much it costs to do the level one. Absolutely mental in coaching. Too much money. Absolutely crazy. They should be paying people to do that course. Or they should be supporting them in a better way, doing, okay, we'll pay for the course, and then you have to do X amount of hours at your local club. Do something like that. Get coaches into the game. Get people that are forward-thinking into the game of football to give England something else. You know, look at the great tactical writing that we have on the internet. So many good websites out there that do really good stuff, yet we don't see any of that injected into our own game. And it's very, very frustrating to see overall, you know, there's so many things that this England team could have done and could have been, could have played certain systems and whatever they played, a 4-4-2 or a 3-5-2 that would have fit this side down to an absolute T. The 3-5-2 with the current squad, a 4-4-2 with other iterations of that team. But again, it just feels like we're kind of going backward. And again, we've got no solution. You know, Gary Neville apparently has left the coaching staff. He's someone that we've seen him do his analytics so, so well on Sky Sports, whether that's been translated to a coaching or whether he can translate that to, you know, as being an assistant manager. I feel that he can do, but we've got to give him support. And, you know, him leaving and him resigning obviously would be from the old boys at the FA, or he's got to go, he's part of that regime, maybe come back and give him a chance. Because quite frankly, there's nobody there we could look and be like, look, he is a revolutionary in the English game, and that is through education, that is through teaching, that's through understanding, but also is through giving these people time.
I do think England is looking, you know, they are looking for a messiah though, and that's the wrong thing to look for.
Yeah, that is the wrong thing. We should be looking to produce a lot of coaches of quality, right, Lawrence?
What they should be looking to do is doing the same as a lot of other countries look for, not just one person to focus everything around. There's a lot of issues in the game, I think, which is probably a longer podcast, but we will find that out. In the coming days, I think there'll be a big post-mortem over England. But yeah, I mean, anyone else seen the great clip tonight of McLaren on Sky?
I was just about to say, on the plus side, we did get Steve McLaren's reaction and analysis on Sky Sports News. He's sort of, after the first England goal, he's sort of waxing lyrical about how England are playing and how they're sort of cutting Iceland apart, and Iceland aren't really offering much. And he's sort of mid-sentence.
When he says, like, I think he says, yeah, it's Gunnarsson. And he's sort of, they've only got one thing, and that's one big guy up front. Oh no. And he's sort of like, oh no. I mean, you feel a bit sorry for Steve, don't you? Because, you know, poor guy.
Poor.
Not in the slightest.
Poor Steve.
No, yeah, I mean, Kristen really doesn't.
I've generally got no sympathy for Steve McLaren.
Why?
No, I've just seen the clip. His face absolutely drops.
Because I think in a lot of ways, Steve McLaren embodies the problem. He's someone who is limited tactically. I think he's actually incredibly stubborn, bordering on smug at times, and I think he's unwilling to embrace modern football in the way that it needs to be embraced. And yet he is still in a prominent position. Yes, he's not coaching at the minute, but he's handed a prominent analysis position. And this is the thing that sometimes gets lost as well, is as much as you want to talk about getting coaches into the game, the people that we use as analysts are arguably just as important because they're influencing and they're shaping the young minds of the game as well.
Yeah,
they're leading the discussion, and you know, look, we can all think of examples, and we've all talked about it off air. Ex-players, ex-coaches who do these commentary gigs on television, and you can tell they're phoning it in. You can tell there's no great interest in what they're doing or any research gone into it. And yet I've sat and watched Taylor Twellman on ESPN, someone who you can tell is consistently reading stuff, consistently ingesting things, and can analyze the game in a very intelligent way. So it is not a field bereft of these people. If anything, there are those who, unfortunately, for the most part, haven't had the greatest playing careers. Those are the ones I find who tend to do the most work, are the ones that maybe don't have achievements to back it up, which is unfortunate. But then,
they still have a good reading of the game.
Yeah, achievements, of course. And this is the thing as well, is you need a lot of changes. Again, Lawrence and Adam, you guys both work in content. You know exactly what it's like when you'll do a video shoot and you'll be handed not name people, but generic ex-professional who, for the most part, will stick to cliche and stick to things that can't really be proved one way or the other, a lot of intangibles, and list those off as being important factors in the game.
But he's cracking banter, Chris. He's cracking banter.
That's the thing. We've replaced analysis with pretty much what is a cheap laugh or a joke.
The question is, did we ever have that analysis, Chris? I think you made some really good points there. I think Danny Drinkwater is one of my favourite pundits. And what, you know, he won stuff at Manchester United, but he had a pretty decent career playing league football. You know, I'd love to be in his position. Danny Higginbottom.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Okay.
Sorry, Lawrence. Sorry, Lawrence. You know, don't kill me.
But no, I just thought I've never seen his analysis. I'd love to see it.
Okay. I know you're a bit upset right now, Lawrence, but people make mistakes.
Yeah.
Yeah, but Duggan Higginbottom, a great analyst. It says the right thing, understands the game, did a lot of work with BT Sport on German football. Credit to him, and he's going the right way. I feel like some of the players that have left the game feel privileged that they deserve to be there, and they don't have to do the hard work anymore. They don't have to do the hard graft. And inherently, why they got to the position they did was because they grafted hard in the younger part of their career. And now leaving it and being in that position, it does kill the game. And it's great what we're saying here. You know, this should be pushed out everywhere. We should send this to the FA and just be like, look, listen to this right now.
Listen to this. There was, of course, another game today, guys, apart from England get dumped out by Iceland. Iceland, of course, going through to face France. It was Spain-Italy. Italy winning 2-0. Lawrence, superbly organised team, dethroning Spain, ending any sort of slim chances they had of winning that unprecedented third European crown.
Yeah, I thought it was a very impressive performance. I mean, Italy did what they needed to do. Both goals of, I think, essentially working on what Spain were not good at, which again we sort of identified as the complacency, not following in after free kicks, leaving certain gaps where they might feel they're strong. Essentially attacking the right areas of Spain, and getting at them in the way they were supposed to. And I think that, that Conte lined them up perfectly. They were intense in all the right areas, and essentially loaded the right parts. You know, it was 3-3-4 at times because of the way they played the fullbacks. Dave and I, we spoke about that on TFR Live. You can go back and watch the analysis of the game at the time. And also, I think what was good about Italy was there was an air of revenge in the air for these Italians, because they remember what went on at the previous tournament. You know, the humiliation they went through in the final. And also, I think this Italy side is somewhat... There's somewhat of an NBA sort of vibe about it, that it's sort of like, you know, it's the sum of its parts. And, you know, we've spoken about that already at the tournament. But some other sides that maybe didn't have the individual talent maybe had to make up for it in other ways. I think people underestimate, I think, what the Italian side is capable of. It's going to be so interesting to see them line up against Germany in the next round. And I think in many ways we're going to see Spain go through another transition now away. And it'd be fascinating to see who they put up as manager next, because, you know, Del Bosque has been there for quite some time now, and, you know, he's benefited from a lot of club work, which is, I think that's there's a big difference between the club work that Spain have got, which is, you know, Real Madrid, Atletico Madrid, Barcelona, who have all looked to put in progressive systems.
That's the thing, isn't it? As good as Italy were, Spain were pretty poor, Dave. I mean, it does show how far they've fallen. I mean, they did suffer that humiliation at the 2010 World Cup, and as Lawrence says, it feels like they need to go in a new direction now after Del Bosque.
The 2014 World Cup, sorry, Adam.
Sorry, that's the
2010 World Cup. Didn't they win that one?
That humiliation.
Did they?
They humiliated everyone else.
I think that this Spain team, you know, we mentioned before, is in massive transition, and they've got no identity at the moment. They weren't on par, and the Italy team was so aggressive. They pressed them well. They played Spain how you should be playing Spain. I was so impressed with both of the wingbacks, Ferenzi and De Siglio were absolutely brilliant. De Siglio winning 3 out of 3 of his tackles, 6 clearances, making 2 interceptions. Defensively was really good, but also going forward created 2 chances. And then Ferenzi was the outlet on the right hand side. I thought they were both brilliant, and they played their positions perfectly. The Spanish team is very narrow. What they were doing, they were pressing Italy's back three with their forward three. Obviously, this opens up space to, firstly, De Rossi, but also their wingbacks. The wingbacks were so good at going out and intercepting the ball at the right time, or pressing at the right time and going and then counter-attacking. And it was Italy-Germany is going to be fascinating. This Italian team has so much work in it. Giaccherini, Pirlo, 2 very aggressive midfielders. You know, what's Giaccherini doing at international tournaments? He's absolutely awesome. if he could pull this to a club of football, he'd be like one of the best players in the world. But probably getting to the end of his career. I think he's around 30, 31 now. Did go to Sunderland. That was his big move. A bit of a mistake. Should have probably stayed in Italy. But he looks...
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Good. He looks so good. And with Bonucci, Barzagli and Chiellini, wow, what a back three. And then Buffon in goal, that save. Obviously, David De Gea got the headlines for the goalkeeper, made, 4 or 5 world-class saves. But Buffon made that crucial save at the end of the game when I think it was still 1-0 to Italy. Yeah. And he made that great save, got down low. But I was so impressed with Italy, as I was when they played Belgium.
I mean, you talk about brilliant. Giaccherini there, Dave, and surely even that just speaks to how well-drilled Conte's got this team and how he's got them. As Lawrence says, that they're more than the sum of their parts. Well, the defence is very strong, they are lacking up front, but they're looking rock solid, Chris. And as these guys are saying, they're going through to play Germany in the next round, and you feel like the winner of that could well go on to win the whole thing.
I really like Italy during this tournament. I've really enjoyed watching them. I think what they represent is the notion, if you can keep at least parts of your team from the same club, it really improves your chemistry a lot. That back four of Buffon, Chiellini, Bonucci, Barzagli does play at club level and played against Morata for most of the season in training, so we'll have known him quite well. And I think that kind of showed in little instances during this game. It's timely that Conte will now be coming to the Premier League, because I think I've seen more positive words about him now than I have in the years prior when he was at Juventus, which is perhaps telling of the way we ingest football. I think in general, this Italian team is well drilled, and it goes back to the discussion we were having with England. A system will usually win you a tournament, not individuals. And the second you move away from the notion of a talisman, I think you start to make progress as a team. Because look at the team that won this, you know, won the World Cup in 2010, Spain, their opponents. There was no standout player for them. There was no talisman. It was about the team. I would argue a similar situation four years on in Brazil and with Germany. Even go to the Italian team of 06. I don't think there's a talisman in that team. I think it's a burden that is shared amongst the squad and amongst the group as a whole. It would be, I think, a little bit naive at this point to say they will definitely win it. I think you're right, though. They have the greatest chance to potentially do it relative to where they started, because people... It's self-included, didn't think they would go far, but I think they've operated with a discipline that will scare most opponents, most particularly Germany, I think, because I don't think Germany can match that level of structure or organisation at this precise moment.
Chelsea fans getting very excited about this one in the TFR Towers. Get very excited about Conte. Be fascinating to see how he gets on next year. And indeed, in this tournament, there was one other little bit of news today, though, we should probably talk about, and that was Lionel Messi announcing his retirement from international football, Chris. This, of course, coming after Argentina lost the Copa America final last night to Chile on penalties. Messi missing one of the penalties, of course, as Argentina lost a third final in 3 years. Now, Messi coming out after the game, some interesting quotes from him. There's the little bit of... There's a gap in there, essentially, for him to come back from this. But he says, I think this is best for everyone. First of all, for me, and then for everyone. I think there's a lot of people who want this who obviously are not satisfied, and we are not satisfied reaching a final and not winning it. It's very hard, but the decision is taken. Now I will not try more, and there will be no going back, is what he says. Now, Chris, obviously very emotional Messi after the game, and some people saying this may not be definite. What's your sort of immediate reaction? Because you're obviously there at the final. You were there seeing Messi in the flesh.
Yeah, I quickly learned what the word terminar means in English, and its significance to what Messi had said. Funnily enough, I was privy to that conversation. I can honestly tell you I didn't understand what was being said, because it was all going quite quickly in Spanish. But he did then come down and do the second mix on and kind of talked a little bit more. What you can say about that is, yes, Messi was hugely emotional. He was in tears at the end of the game. And even when the fifth Chilean penalty goes in, my eyes were kind of drawn to the Argentina team to see the contrast between emotion, because as the Chile bench and everything flooded towards their goal scorer, the Argentinians, for the most part, just collapsed, because there was so much history riding on this game. I mean, Olé, the big sports paper, ran the headline, "We can't lose going into this game." And in the piece I did for Yahoo, I kind of toyed with the notion of maybe it's like bragging, kind of, you know, we can't lose, we're so brilliant. Or actually it was intense nerves, the notion of we can't lose a third final in 3 years. Because that's the other thing. This was, I think, Messi's fourth final now. I believe Mascherano's lost five finals with them. They have really cemented an idea of being serial chokers at international level. And, you know, that was the question asked of Tata Martino in his press conference after, is how do you explain this? And he did kind of climb into a real ambiguous answer and say, you know, our players know that these things can happen. I thought we deserved to win it in the 90, in the 120 minutes, but we didn't. These things happen. I think, honestly, there is a mentality issue with Argentina at this point. They looked incredibly meek for large portions of this game. Funnily enough, prior to Messi's confirmation of retirement, the big talking point was the referee.
He should definitely consider retiring.
Well, I mean, look, if you look at his refereeing record, he sent, I think, four players off in his last five games.
Yeah, he loves a card.
He loves a card. He even Roberto Rojas was telling me that he even refereed the game between these two in World Cup qualifying earlier in the year, and that game he handed out 6 yellow cards, and he just didn't have control of things. You could see it. Every time there was a decision, the players would surround him. In fact, for Marcelo Diaz's second yellow card, it's Messi that is gesturing instantly to get him a booking after he fouls him. And it was a poor first half, really. I think the second half you saw a little bit more football, but throughout the 90, even 120 minutes, there was just flickers of brilliance from Messi, just kind of the trademark of what you expect. He would look great with the ball at his feet, but that final moment that he needed was an issue. But I think if you're looking as well to appropriate blame, you have to give a good portion to Gonzalo Higuain, because he has the best chance for Argentina. Credit also to Claudio Bravo for producing a really sensational save from a Kun Aguero header. But that doesn't explain the fact that Gonzalo Higuain, one-on-one, decides to chip it instead of just smashing it. Just side foot anything. Don't try and... On the one hand, it was needlessly complicated. On the other hand, to me, it spoke of someone who was very nervous. And I wanted to ask Martino at the end, was he at all concerned when that chance went begging? Because there was just something about the way he approached it. Having seen him for Napoli this season and the confidence he plays with, there was just this hesitation in the way he approached the ball when he was going to strike it. I think the difficulty with this game is, though, we're so focused on Argentina because of the prominent story that broke after it. Ole's headline today, funnily enough, was "Don't Go," with Messi on the front cover, of course. I think Chile deserve immense credit as well, though, because they played this game expertly. I didn't give them a huge chance going into it. I did think that Argentina would finally break that duck and break the hoodoo. But what you have to say about Juan Antonio Pizzi is he's developed a very assured style, a very confident style, that is really difficult to play against. It's high intensity, it's high pace, but not to the point where they burn themselves out. They've got enough key components, Arangui, Sanchez, who can keep going for 120 minutes, basically. They were running pretty much the pair of them. And that allows them to pressure teams in a way that I think few in the world can. And it really didn't settle Argentina at parts for this game. And I think it's interesting that he said, you know, they've raised their ceiling, this team, and he hopes that they keep doing that, because I think we could start to see something with Chile now. There's just something about the way they play. I think if they can maintain the structure that they have with Pizzi, that maybe they didn't have defensively with Sampaoli, we could start to see them really do something in not only CONMEBOL, but also on a world stage.
Chris, I see you've already started tweeting certain managers to see if they're still free.
I did jokingly tweet an account that was linked to Marcelo Bielsa, saying if he wanted the England job. But I mean, you know, that's the thing. He would be
so perfect
for that.
really
to try and give
up.
Them, yeah, just to kind of give them a little bit of vim and vigor. And you know, this is the thing. I think he could inspire them a little bit as well, because Dimitri Payet said just last week that when he worked with Bielsa at Marseille, he really bought into it, and he told this anecdote of, I think it's Mandanda he turns to and says, after a team talk from Bielsa, "I would die for this man now." Now, that might sound quite sensationalist, quite melodramatic. I think it gives you just a window into what Bielsa can achieve, though, I think, and what he can inspire in players. And I think England's players need that. They need a bit of inspiration. But I think ultimately, to draw it back to Messi, if we can, the retirement, when you actually look at the facts and you look at the timeline, is not a huge surprise, because he's never been universally accepted by this public in Argentina. They've for long periods seen him as kind of a foreigner that plays for the national team, a Spaniard or a Catalan that represents Argentina. We've discussed before the fact that for a long period he was pitted against Tevez on the national team, and Tevez was the player of the people. And even when they went out of the 2011 Copa America and Tevez misses the penalty, it's still Messi that gets blamed. He's still the one that has to take the buck. And I think there comes a point where you tire of that. You know, you tire of trying to prove yourself to people that, for the most part, will likely never accept you as one of their own. And I think in terms of his retirement, you know, I did something with Adam for the Football Republic in which I said maybe it wasn't the best idea. Okay. I think the benefit for him is he can go away now and decide if he really wants this. He can spend some time away from the national team and watch them from a distance and see, do I miss that? Do I miss the training camps? Do I miss being with the guys? Do I miss the opportunity to leave that legacy? Or am I willing to accept that my legacy with Argentina will be a runners-up medal for the most part?
Well, it does also seem like there are elements that he's posturing a little bit with the guys who are at the top, doesn't it? I mean, that's at least the theory, that he's sort of, there's elements of you don't know what you've got until it's gone. There are also elements of that, you know, essentially he's not very happy with the AFA.
Of course. I mean, look, this is the thing as well. I think of the rush of emotions and everything that was in the press box and in the press room when this was announced. I can only imagine the complexity of emotion that he felt, having lost that fourth final, having struggled to get himself that winner's medal that he so much desired. And as you rightly say, Lawrence, he's had issues with the AFA. He referred to them as a disaster after their flight in Houston was delayed. And the AFA in general...
Did that brilliant Instagram, didn't he? Did a little Instagram post.
I mean, this is the thing. It's difficult to brand the AFA as anything other than a disaster at the minute because of the situation they're in. FIFA has already had to come in and take over things and sort things out. That story really is far from concluded.
You know there's an issue when FIFA are coming in and sorting out your problems.
Yeah, exactly. It's a difficulty that, again, I think plays into the emotion of he just looked very tired last night. He looked very tired. He looked drained. He looked upset. And again, it is the heat of the moment.
I think that's what's
motivated the decision.
I'm sure those frustrations with the AFA sort of contributed, but I doubt it was that. I doubt it's some sort of game of brinkmanship. As Lauren said, it seems like it's very, it seems like quite an emotional decision. I mean, what have you made of the reaction to it, Lawrence, in terms of, I know Chris is talking about how in Argentina, maybe he's never really been in the hearts of the fans there, but even in a broader sense, people are calling this a cowardly decision, criticising him for sort of walking out on the national team without, you know, winning anything. As Chris says, his legacy will be as a runner-up. Do you think that's fair, or do you think you have to sort of appreciate the toll all of the pressures and all of the frustrations have taken on it?
Well, I think obviously journalists are going to take... There are some journalists who probably wouldn't think about writing 1,000 words on something and only taking 1,000 words with one angle. But I do also think there are some journalists who are sort of taking a little bit longer with it. I also think it's a poor understanding of the culture and where Messi might be coming from. You know, I was talking to a couple of guys who were saying, you know, Ronaldo doesn't celebrate so readily with his teammates because he believes that it somewhat takes away the limelight from the rest of the guys. And that, you know, while that is somewhat of a humble brag, because it's sort of like, oh God, I'm so famous, I really shouldn't be around you guys. It is also a sort of like, there's something quite sad and lonely about that, that I think a lot of people don't understand what it's like to be at the top. We've seen so many other people kind of fall from that. You know, I think with Messi especially, it does become a bit, you know, there is even more that he carries quite a lot himself. Also that he has... how can I put it? You know, when you're at the very top and there are so many pulls and constraints on you, I think that there are issues that he needs to step away from. And it is about stepping away from that and allowing other people to grow into the situation sometimes. He's still relatively young. I don't think anyone takes that sort of decision lightly, not least Messi, because, you know, not only is it about him enjoying his football, but it's also about building a legacy in that country and seeing what has happened with other great superstars there. It's also about, you know, how marketable can you be if you're not playing for your international side? So I think there's a lot of different directions that Messi's going to be pulled in. I think he's more astute than a lot of people let on. Whilst he's silent, that doesn't mean he's stupid. You know, I think a lot of people sort of think, well, you know, he's a young, humble guy. I do think he sort of allows other people to assume a lot of things, and that must also take a lot of strength. And at the same time, you know, I think it must be incredibly frustrating to be in his situation. So I think it's also difficult to write about someone who's incredibly private, because very often you see journalists taking their own way of thinking and putting it onto someone else and sort of going, well, he must be thinking this way. And I imagine there are a few people out there that are able to understand that situation because it is so unique. At the same time, I think football is, for some weird reason, a place which is full of so much judgment of other people. Mm. You know, it's very often, I think, that actually there's, you know, there are some truisms in football. And actually, I think some teams are almost free of that. Iceland are a team that are free of judgment. You know, it's essentially just enjoying the ride, enjoying the trip and enjoying what their team are doing. Chile have had their problems, but there is also a lot of positivity around that side. And, you know, what we saw, we see a lot of the positives when they are free of that judgment. And I think we're seeing a lot of that now is actually most people are being brought down by the issues which surround them, as opposed to the issues which are maybe the ones they should be addressing. And same for Messi, essentially.
Dave, do you think there does seem to be this suspicion that people think he'll be back for Russia? I mean, as Lawrence points out, there's a lot of factors coming into it. I mean, we spoke to Juan from Now Nation earlier, who said that he doesn't think Adidas will be particularly happy with him playing in a Nike shirt of Barcelona all the time and not in the Adidas shirt of Argentina. And those are the sort of pressures you do have as a modern footballer. A lot of people saying, you know, 2 years out, come back for the World Cup, potentially end his international career there with his legacy a bit closer to Diego Maradona, who of course he's always compared with. Do you think this is the end for him, or do you suspect he's going to come back eventually?
Well, you know, I hope he comes back. I think he's a player that you know, needs to do it on the international stage for some people. Some people compare him with Maradona. He's better than Maradona. Lionel Messi's goal-scoring record is a joke. You watch Maradona, you watch Lionel Messi. Maradona did it in a few games. Lionel Messi does it every single time he plays football. Look at his record at the Copa America. Absolutely crazy stats. He's directly involved in a goal every 38 minutes at the tournament. That's insane. Absolutely insane numbers. What, so he's nearly directly involved in 3 goals a game? That's crazy. That's carrying a team by the scruff of the neck. I think he's fine. He takes the time off. What's the point of Lionel Messi travelling around for the qualifiers? Doesn't need to. He can go and he can take some time off and then come back for the tournament. He'll get in the team.
Well, because there is also part of the... It is also partly, well, there's an experience in football. You know, go have a good experience. Enjoy your football.
Mm.
You know, don't just come in when it's like, right, can we win now? Great, let's win.
But that's not the get. I think he's lost.
You know, helping his team go to the tournament, you know, and he should be sort of doing more to help his national team.
But I think I'm probably the wrong person to ask this question because I'm massively for club football over.
He's getting in the car.
That's the Messi alarm.
over for club football over international football. I'm right. Not massively excited when I watch England. It's just one of those things. I can't.
Don't blame you.
I'm massively excited when I watch good football. I was very excited by watching Spain, and
that excites me more.
Yeah.
And I just feel that you know, if Lionel Messi doesn't want to play, I'd rather see him play for Barcelona. He's better for Barcelona. He plays with those Barcelona players every single day when he's obviously at the club, and that's a bet. You know, there's more fluidity in that style. They know what he's going to do. They have an appreciation of what he's going to do. And I just feel it's a bit better watching Messi for Barcelona than watching Messi for Argentina.
The thing is, though, as a player, as a, you know, for his legacy almost, he is, for me, the greatest player of all time. But for a lot of people, this is putting a black mark on his career. So to walk out on a team like this when he is the best player in the world, the most influential player in the national team.
I don't think he's walking out, though. Essentially, if he was
that's
the
what
only...
people are accusing.
Yeah, but if he was the only person in that side that was fantastic, then you'd sort of be like, oh my God, he's left this team bare. They've built everything around him. To some extent, they have. But at the same time, they have other leaders, Mascherano in there. Like you say, Higuain is still a pretty key striker for them. Aguero is fantastic. You know, Maxi Rodriguez was still a fairly sort of prominent player in that side for quite a while because of the way that he treated Argentina. You've got so many of them. Di Maria.
Mascherano has retired.
Yeah, but no, but you know what I'm saying is that it's not just. I mean, I'm more gutted that Mascherano is retired than anyone else. But you know, I also think that it's also the emphasis that we put on players and people at that time. I do think in the fullness of time, the fullness of history, we see the significance of those people. And I do think that at the moment, our eyes are drawn to look at this icon, look at all his individual achievements, look at this, look at that, because that's what football's looking for at that time. And you know, essentially, we will look back at some point and think, God, the media ire and the number of eyes on one guy must have, that's ridiculous. And I think we will appreciate the achievements in another way even very soon, I imagine, even in just a few weeks, you know, even in a couple of years and we look back. So I think there's a lot more to it. And I think, you know, Messi and Ronaldo and a couple of those other guys are very much crafting that because they've learned from other guys. They have learned from the likes of, I mean, essentially the blueprint was laid down by O.J. Simpson. And that, you know, it's no joke. And that was followed by Michael Jordan. And, you know, the original Ronaldo tried to follow that as well. If he hadn't have been so plagued with injuries, then we would have seen a similar sort of legacy laid down by him. Cristiano follows it. Messi follows it.
Fucking dinner party this is turning out to be, by the way.
But, yeah, but you know what I mean, though, that these guys are building a brand. And that brand, the word brand is synonymous and a synonym for so many other things that go on in football and go on in sports in general. And I think Messi realises a lot more than maybe some other people who are writing in the short term do.
I do feel like, you know, there is, as you said, there's so much focus and so much pressure on Messi. And when things go wrong, and, you know, obviously this is a massive story, him retiring from international football, it becomes all about Messi, and it becomes such a negative thing when it's harder to say he dragged Argentina, it feels like, to this final. This time he's been sensational. Copa America, yeah, again in 2015 last year he was very
World Cup.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That's the other way to look at it, and people don't really look at it from that side of the story and go, you know, okay, he's been incredible for Argentina.
I disagree with that, though.
Yeah,
I disagree with the notion he dragged them to this final. I think, look,
has he not been influential, decisive in this tournament?
I think he supplemented what was a very good team. I mean, look, they started this competition without him. They'd all but qualified by the time he rocked up anyway. They beat Chile without him in the first game of their first game of the competition, excuse me. So the thing is, I think you have to be careful in not only not deriding him too much and saying he is a failure, but then also on the flip side, not saying that he is the difference and the only reason the other 10 players standing on the pitch in the Copa America final. I think the truth of the matter lies is that the team as a whole did not show up against Chile. The only one, honestly, I think that can come out of that final and say, you know what, I did pretty much everything I could, was Javier Mascherano. Now, for me, and I'm potentially going to write this as well, perhaps for the Front Two blog, is I think the bigger disappointment is that Mascherano didn't take a title away now because he's retired, because that is a man who is Mr. Dependable. This is a guy who's played for his country for, I think, going on 13 years now, had made a senior appearance for the national team before he'd even made a senior appearance for River Plate. And yet, despite his dependency or his dependability, excuse me, and his reliability for that team in major games, he's going to leave the national team with a lot of runners-up medals. The bigger issue, I think, if you're talking about replacing players who are retiring, I think the bigger issue is replacing Mascherano, because so consistently throughout this tournament, he has been the one that's organised the back line and also the midfield and kept things composed and kept things tidy. And when he's had a bad game or he's had a wobble, that usually has been the precursor to Argentina having a wobble. It's funny that against Venezuela, the 15-minute period that Tata Martino talks about when Venezuela disrupted the game, it came almost exactly the moment after Mascherano had a little bit of a wobble himself. And I think for me, he's the bigger fulcrum in terms of the team dynamic and the way that they maintain their composure and all that thing than Messi's. Messi's influential in the attack. But for me, Mascherano is the most important cog.
It just feels like, you know, was it 5 goals, 5 assists, and already people are forgetting about that and going, it's failure for Messi. It's another failure. And failing to recognise at least the contribution he made. Even if, you know, as you say, Chris, and you know more than me, Mascherano is more vile to that. People are ignoring the fact that Messi helped get him there. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, of course. I mean, like I said, the difficulty he faces himself is, they're never going to accept him, realistically. It's always, what have you done for me lately? That's the problem he'll always face. And he either has to accept that and and take it on board and just acknowledge he will never be appreciated. Or, as he has done for the time being, he's chosen to remove himself from the situation and focus solely on his club form.
Let's see if he comes back. Let's see how it pans out. But for now, Lionel Messi has announced his retirement from international football.
I also think there are darker forces at play, but maybe that's something we can't talk about. I think Messi owes a lot to a lot of people in Europe. I think a few of those people still have influence over his camp. But that's something that we can't really comment on. But I think Barcelona and a couple of other institutions out there definitely have more influence than we can acknowledge.
Interesting and mysterious.
Right, for seeing them with your crazy theories.
Let's leave it on the good news, on the optimistic note that Alan Shearer has hinted he wants to be the next England manager.
What were his exact words? Was it
Shearer says he was turned down for the job previously
due to lack of experience? And apparently, sitting around on a couch and having chats with people makes you more qualified.
Hey, Gary Lineker pointed out that Beckenbauer won with West Germany with no experience. So, you know.
Yeah, but Beckenbauer was a great thinker of the game.
So who's Alan Shearer, Dave?
The management pervert.
So who's Alan Shearer?
Okay, sorry, Adam.
Good. I accept your apology. But now though, guys, thank you so much for listening to the Front Three. Let us know your thoughts on England crashing out of the Euros at the usual place on Twitter. At the Front Three with the number, not the word. We'll be back tomorrow to talk about maybe who's going to be the next England manager, more fallout from the whole situation, as well as our previews of some of the quarterfinals coming up. For now, though, Chris, it's been an absolute pleasure. Your time in America is coming to an end.
No, you've still got quite a lot. You've still got like another 2 weeks, right?
2 weeks?
Yeah, I'll be at the New York Derby probably next weekend, so that's kind of my next. Taking a few days off down in Florida, and then I'll be back up for another game.
We'll have a bloody good time. Dave, a pleasure as always to speak to you.
Oh, thanks, mate. You know, we also need to talk about the other games that we didn't chat about, you know, Poland, Portugal.
There's
a lot of good football.
That's tomorrow, Dave. We're going to go through
everything. Yeah, that's
everything.
What I mean.
Come back tomorrow for more fun. But also, go on to @SquawkerDave and just click retweet on the top tweet. It's currently banging. It's blown up. It's exploded. Now the listeners need to go check it out themselves.
Yeah, but Dave, what number is it on at the moment? Go and triple that number.
It's on 1,500 and something retweets.
Tell you what.
1,500.
Wow, that's banged, mate. That is truly banged.
My Twitter won't even work on my phone at the moment.
How did you get it to bang so hard?
I don't know. I just think it was a good tweet. You know, you put the work in sometimes on Twitter and they bang. Other times they don't.
Oh, did Squawker nick your tweet?
No, that ain't talking about me.
Can I... Dave, I've just given Rashford a little tweet on the Front Three. You don't even have to go to Squawker Dave anymore. You can just go to our podcast account and you can take a look. Thanks for coming.
Ooh, I love it.
Yeah.
That's Lawrence, why else should the people come back tomorrow to listen?
We've got plenty more funny stories from this. You know what I discovered the other day, which I'll tease it a little bit. I've been fascinated to see that some guys who are in the game, Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, has got a father who has an Instagram, which is just Papa Aubameyang. Now, it is a fantastic, account. This guy basically just posts consistent pictures with his son, and it is brilliant. Let me see if I can find it for you again.
Let's just leave the listeners with that, because that is quite something. Papa Aubameyang.
Have you found it?
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. So if you search, I think if you search Papa Aubameyang, there are some just great pictures of just him and his son.
Oh, he seems like a really top bloke, doesn't he?
Yeah, it is.
Seems dead happy.
There we go, found him. Aubameyang Papa. It's Aubameyang.papa. And it's basically him and his son looking like an absolute player. But him, just a series of pictures with his son. He's so excited and so happy. It's brilliant.
Can we set up O'Brien.papa and it's just Dave and his dad?
Dave and his dad.
Oh, that'd be nice.
Can we do the front three?
Dave's an absolute player, as we all know. So I think
It would work. Dave's dad's an absolute player.
The other way around, you know?
Yeah.
The dad's the player in many ways. On that note, guys, that brings an end from three. Thanks again for listening, and we'll speak to you tomorrow.
Bye-bye.
What's goodbye in Icelandic?
You suck.
Fuck off, home.
It's probably along the lines. It's probably. Did you see? You know, the best bit was actually.
Bless.
Wasn't it when all the Icelandic players went down to the Icelandic end, and all the Icelandic fans were doing the clap, and the players did it with them? See, that's the kind of moment that the England fans want.
Yeah, I agree with that.
They just want.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Dave. Connect by heart with these multimillionaires.